Picture a crippled man with a bad leg navigating treacherous log rafts down North Carolina's Cape Fear River in the early 1900s. Dawson Jordan was short, stocky, and fearless, finding his only peace on those dangerous waters. Fast forward 60 years, and his great-grandson would find similar sanctuary on basketball courts, transforming that inherited resilience into something the world had never seen. Michael Jordan didn't just play basketball, he became the standard by which all human excellence is measured. When Barack Obama handed him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, he captured it perfectly. There is a reason you call someone the Michael Jordan of something. But how does a boy from Wilmington, North Carolina, become the measuring stick for greatness itself? The answer lies in generations of survival, family secrets, and a competitive fire so intense it could melt steel. When tuberculosis claimed his wife in 1916, Dawson Jordan kept his one-year-old son, William Edward, a radical choice for a black widower in Jim Crow South. They lived in coastal shacks near Wilmington, forging an unbreakable bond in a region scarred by the 1898 massacre. Dawson's grandson, James Raymond Jordan, inherited that toughness but added charm and mechanical skill. He met 15-year-old Dolores Peoples, daughter of an ambitious moonshiner who owned his land. Despite her father's disapproval, they married young. Michael was born on February 17, 1963, struggling to breathe with a nosebleed. "Michael was the happiness he sent me after a very sad time in my life," Dolores said, mourning her mother's sudden death. Behind the family facade lurked darker truths. Violent arguments sent children fleeing to grandparents. When Michael was 12, his sister Sis revealed that James had sexually abused her for 8 years. After a volatile confrontation, Dolores chose family preservation over reporting it. Michael remained unaware for years. These secrets created fault lines beneath the perfect public image, forging the titanium will that would define his greatness. Michael's competitive fire ignited at the smallest provocations, but the deepest wound came from his father, James, who dismissed him with, "Just go on in the house with the women," when Michael couldn't identify tools during car repairs. This challenge to his masculinity activated something nuclear in Michael's psyche. The backyard wars with his brother Larry intensified this drive. Despite being taller, Michael lost consistently to his shorter, stronger brother for over a year. These weren't games, they were gladiatorial contests that taught Michael to seek out the best player and destroy them. He'd later inflict this on James Worthy at UNC. His mission was to seek out the best player on the team, and I was that guy. He was a bully, and he bullied me. When 15-year-old Michael got cut from Laney High's varsity team in 1978, the devastation deepened when coaches didn't bring him up for playoffs, despite this being customary. Jordan became a team statistician just to attend games, secretly hoping they'd lose to prove they needed him. Obsessed with growing taller, he hung from bars and put salt in his shoes before bed. He shot up to 6'3 by summer, eventually reaching 6'6. Sometimes our greatest gifts arrive wrapped in rejection. When Jordan arrived at Dean Smith's five-star camp in Pittsburgh, he saw himself as a country boy from Wilmington, facing 17 high school All-Americans. He was terrified. Then he dominated, reportedly scoring 40 points in one half, winning multiple trophies and being named MVP. Tom Konchalski recognized him as a rare one-possession player, someone whose exceptional talent was evident in a single glimpse. Jordan called it the turning point of my life. At Chapel Hill, Jordan faced his greatest challenge, submitting to Dean Smith's structured system after years of instinctive play. When Sports Illustrated wanted freshman Jordan on their college preview cover, Smith refused. Jordan was deeply offended, but absorbed this slight into his growing reservoir of motivation. Then came March 29, 1982, the NCAA championship game against Georgetown. With 15 seconds remaining and Carolina trailing by one, Jordan sank a 16-foot jumper from the left wing. That shot launched Jordan's legend and taught him he could deliver when everything was on the line. Confidence isn't something you're born with. It's something you earn in moments that terrify you. After Houston took Hakeem Olajuwon first and Portland's disastrous pick of Sam Bowie second, Chicago grabbed Jordan third. Nike, desperate and struggling, offered unprecedented wealth to a 21-year-old who hadn't played a minute of professional basketball. Sonny Vaccaro saw Dolores Jordan's reaction as a Black power moment, economic empowerment rooted in North Carolina's Black business tradition. Phil Knight never officially approved the deal, but let it proceed, a gamble that could have bankrupted Nike. When Nike released the red and black Air Jordans in early 1985, the NBA banned them for violating uniform regulations. Nike transformed this restriction into marketing genius. When you tell the public that something is banned, what does the public always do? Vaccaro recalled. Rebellion sells, especially wrapped in style and defiance. Jordan's rookie season transformed the Bulls instantly. By his third game, he exploded for 37 points. Larry Bird declared, "I've never seen one player turn a team around like that." But the 1985 All-Star Weekend became infamous when veteran stars allegedly froze out the rookie, planting seeds of animosity that fueled his competitive fire for years. Jordan's fame imprisoned him. Commercial flights became impossible as fans would lose their fucking minds. Nike and the NBA created that Michael Jackson kind of life where privacy vanished. His entourage called him Black Cat and navigated his relentless competitive nature. A broken navicular bone in his second season threatened everything. Bulls management restricted his return to 7 minutes per half, making him feel like property. He responded with 63 points against Boston in a playoff double overtime loss, prompting Larry Bird's legendary comment, "That's God disguised as Michael Jordan." Phil Jackson changed everything. He protected the team from Jordan's fame, addressing his selfishness while acknowledging his special status. Jackson created barriers between players, media, and management, what Johnny Bock called a magical combination where no one was in the way. In 1991, the Bulls defeated the Pistons and Magic's Lakers for their first championship. Jordan broke down in tears. Magic told him, "You've proved everyone wrong. Greatness isn't just about winning. It's about proving the doubters wrong." Fresh off his first championship, Jordan lost $626,000 in a 10-day gambling spree. Three consecutive championships had drained him. Then, on July 22, 1993, everything shattered. James Jordan left home in his Cranberry Lexus, a gift from Michael, with vanity plate UNC0023, to attend a funeral. He never arrived. Police discovered the abandoned Lexus on August 5, connecting it to a badly decomposed body found in a creek. Two 18-year-olds had shot James as he rested alongside Interstate 95. By fall, Jordan told Reinsdorf he wanted to retire, not over money, but because he'd lost his motivation. On October 6, 1993, he announced his retirement, cryptically suggesting he might return 5 years down the road. Jordan sought relief in baseball, the game his father loved. "It was really his father's dream that he play baseball," Phil Jackson observed. "When his father passed away, I think Michael was kind of living out his father's dream." After quitting due to the MLB strike, Jordan began appearing at Bulls practices in March 1995. On March 18th, he ended speculation with a two-word press release, "I'm back." Jordan's 2009 Hall of Fame induction became controversial when he used his speech to revisit every slight that fueled his competitive fire. As majority owner of the Charlotte Bobcats, he faced unprecedented humiliation when his team finished 7-59 in 2012, the NBA's worst season ever. Jordan's story reveals how greatness isn't born, but forged in furnaces of adversity.